Order. Welcome to the February 19th meeting of the Monterey Bay Air Resources District Board of Directors. We have the Pledge of Allegiance led by Supervisor.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
I've been asked just to remind directors to turn your mic on when you speak so the public can hear. It's just pushing the green button. It's kind of a very simple button. Push it for green and push it red for.
And we have Supervisor Leahy on there.
Which one? I know.
And then we have Supervisor Leahy joining us remotely, so I will go to
Yes, good afternoon, board. Supervisor Leahy is going to be invoking the AB 2449 just cause attendance. He's appearing remotely. He is not feeling well. So I'll make this statement for the rector or for the record. Director Leahy will participate remotely in accordance with AB 2449 using the just cause provision under item 3. Supervisor Leahy, can you confirm that you're not feeling well today?
Yes, everybody. I've been sick all weekend. I'm getting better today, but still not 100% yet. And I don't want to get anyone else sick there at the meeting. So, so for the sake of all of our health of everyone, I'm staying home. So I'm invoking this today for today's meeting.
And one other question: is there anyone in the room with you over the age of 18?
No, there isn't.
Okay, thank you, Supervisor. And from there, we can go on.
Thank you very much. We'll go to roll call.
All right. Director Leahy.
Present.
Thank you. Director Eskew. Director Carbone.
Present.
Director DeSerpa.
Sorry.
Present.
Director Hernandez.
Present.
Director Jensen.
Present.
Vice Chair Kosmicki. I'm here. Director Labar.
Present.
Chair Lopez. Absent. Director Montesino. Director Sandoval, you have quorum, sir.
Thank you very much. And that would take us to item 5, election of 2025 Board of Directors, Chair and Vice Chair. And the board will receive recommendation from the Budget Personnel and Nominating Committee.
We have number 4.
And I think they need to turn on the
chair. That's the most important one. Oh, I'm so sorry about that. Yeah. Apologize for that. Yeah, so we're welcome. Actually, we have quite a turnover on the board, so this is very important. And welcome to new members to the board of directors. And we have the list here on the agenda. So welcome to Luisa Leahy representing Monterey County Board, Kimberly DeSerpa from the from Santa Cruz County Board, Jerry Jensen from Capitola City Council, Eduardo Montesino from the Watsonville City Council, and Andrew Sandoval from the Salinas City Council. So welcome to you all. Does anybody have any comments or questions they want to bring to the table here? Hearing none, thank you all for being here. And then that would take us to item 5, election of 2025 Board of Directors, Chair and Vice Chair, and receiving the recommendation from the Budget Personnel and Nominating Committee. Rich, do you want to take it?
Yes, good afternoon, Chair and Board. Similar to what I explained to the Budget Personnel Nominating Committee, we have tried and strived to trade off among the counties and city representation on our board. That's not a requirement, however, under our bylaws, so we can have folks go again if they want. Chris Lopez is the outgoing chair, and then Colin, you're the vice chair. Typically it follows in that order, but doesn't have to. So based on somebody's willingness and availability to serve, seems to be two of the paramount factors.
Thank you very much. And the nominating committee and represented myself as vice chair to go to chair, and Felipe Hernandez to be vice chair in 2025. Do you have any further comments or questions? Do we need to go to public comment? Let's go to public comment.
No one's hand is raised online. Nothing received, and no one in the boardroom.
Yeah, I would just entertain if there is a nomination for chair and vice chair.
I'd like to nominate Colin Kosmicki as chair and Felipe Hernandez as our vice chair for 2025.
Perfect. We'll second.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll have a roll call vote. We have somebody on remote here.
All right. Director Alejo.
Aye.
Director Eskew.
Aye.
Director Carbone.
Aye.
Director De Serpa.
Aye.
Director Hernandez.
Aye.
Director Jensen.
Aye.
Director Kosmicki.
Aye.
Director Labar.
Aye.
Director Montesino.
Aye.
You have unanimous approval.
Great, thank you very much. That would take us to item six, presentations, recognition of outgoing chair of the board of directors, Chris Lopez of Monterey County Board of Supervisors.
Thank you, Chair, members of the board. This is further enticement and look what you can get if you become chair. So by way of example, we called Chris's office and we hear he's got an addiction problem to coffee. And so we've loaded this up with our 50th anniversary Yeti mug, as well as different caffeine delivery systems. So we will do our homework for the next chair moving forward. So we just wanted to recognize Chris and what a great job he did this past year.
Great, thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? I would just add that, you know, Supervisor Lopez did an excellent job running these meetings. I'll do my best to fill his shoes. And he's always been committed here, but I'm sure he's getting happy wherever he is. That will take us, there's nothing further. Do we have a public comment on that?
No hands raised online, nothing received, and no one in the boardroom.
Great. That would take us to general public comment, item number seven. Do we have any public comment for items that are not on the agenda?
Nothing received, no hands raised online, and no hands in the boardroom.
Great. That would take us to item eight, reports by committee chairs on committee meetings. First would be budget, personnel, and nominating committee. So we did meet right before this meeting here today at 12:30 and gave the recommendation for committee chair and vice chair. And then we also approved recommending we'll receive a report on OPEB benefits, trust and pension trust accounts for the quarter ended December 31st, additional report, Monterey County Treasurer's report, investments for the quarter ended December 31st, and we received a report on the recommended adoption of resolution approving 2024 budget revisions for Schedule A to the Board of Directors. I would just refer all the directors if you want further information. We have
the chair has a turn on his mic, please.
Oh, you can't. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm not talking.
Now we can hear you, Colin.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. I'll try not to be a low talker. Just referring everybody. Thank you. I need that myself. Referring everybody to the budget, personnel, nominating committee agenda. If you'd like to go through further data and those items as well on this agenda later in the meeting. And other than that, we also recommended approval to the board of directors to add an air quality planner to the planning division, item 10 on it. Well, and that's also was on consent today. That's it. Thank you very much. And we take us to advisory committee.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. The advisory committee did meet earlier this month. However, we did not have a quorum. So we had an informational meeting only and no action was taken on any of the items, which gives me the opportunity to remind board members now, especially the newer folks, that you have the ability to nominate and select two individuals to participate on our advisory committee. And we've got some folks that have been showing up on the advisory committee. I'm not sure they've been appointed in the last 10 years, and they're sort of outliving their the folks who appointed them. So it would be really great to have more representatives on that board. And then a standing item, which is a little off topic, is we do need members on our hearing board as well. And that would be a engineer as well as a medical professional. That concludes my remarks on that.
Any comments or questions from the board? Hearing none, that would take us to item nine. Do we have any broader comments or referrals from the chair or board members? Hearing none, that would take us to the consent agenda. The consent consists of items considered routine or non-controversial. Needing one motion. Are there any of the items from agenda item 10 through 19 that the board would like to pull or members of the audience? Hearing none, can I entertain a motion to approve consent? First, we have a second. All those in favor, roll call vote, please.
Second was Eskew?
Yes. Yeah,
thank you. Director Alejo?
Aye.
Director Eskew?
Aye.
Director Carbone?
Aye.
Director De Serpa?
Aye.
Director Hernandez?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Chair Kusmicki?
Aye.
Director Labar?
Aye.
Director Montesino?
Yes.
Approved unanimously.
Thank you very much. That would take us to the regular agenda. We do public comment on consent. Really know that I...
More or less you did. Okay. I don't know that we heard confirmation, but...
I think we did. Okay, sorry about that.
You're good.
I just want to make sure. That would take us to the regular agenda, item 20, which is received presentation by Regen Monterey on smart landfill gas collection.
Good afternoon, MBAR Chair, Vice Chair, and all the board members. My name is Felipe Melcher. I'm the General Manager at Regen Monterey. I just wanted to do a small introduction of who we are before we go into the presentation. We are a Class 3 landfill, the scientifically engineered facility designed to hold and isolate waste from the environment. It's regulated by state and local governments. We are located in the unincorporated Monterey County, just north of Marina. It was established in 1951. We started filling in the landfill in 1965. Currently it's 475 acres, 315, which is permitted for landfill activities. We are a public service, helping the public manage waste that they don't handle at home or can't handle on their own. We offer innovative services to the public, single stream recycling for all the recyclable materials, composting service for your green waste and food scrap collection. We have landfilling operations. We have landfill gas to energy. We create 5 megawatts of power. We provide service for household hazardous waste disposal so that doesn't wind up in the landfill. And we're here to present a little bit about some of the innovation and technology that is representing Regen Monterey, also known as Monterey Regional Waste Management District. Our forefathers had this grand thought to take care of our beaches and our environment around us, and we want to be able to continue that. And I think this technology is a representation that our board supports us in technology and innovation that sustains the sustainability for our environment. So thank you for having us here today.
Thanks for introducing Regen, Felipe, and good afternoon, Chair Kusmicki and members of the board. I wanted to also thank the staff at MBARC for inviting us to come speak. It's rare that we come talk to you and let you know of all the great things that are happening at Regen, and this is a really good opportunity to kind of start that endeavor. So we can go to the first slide, please. But I'd start out with a little bit of Landfill 101. Unlike me, you probably don't live and breathe landfill every day, and I wanted to start out with this. Regen has a landfill on site. It's located about a mile north of the city of Marina. There we handle the municipal solid waste of the community that surrounds us. And on that landfill, we have a living, breathing organism. As the waste decomposes, it's generating a gas called landfill gas that has methane in it. The reason that is important to this body is that methane is about 25 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas, in the atmosphere. So what this regulating body does here, MBAR, regulates us to make sure that we're not emitting too much of that gas into the atmosphere. And so we're required by regulation to install landfill gas wells. If we can go to the next slide. Those landfill gas wells are shown on this map. You see that kind of jumbled area, that's the trash represented by number one. Number two shows these landfill gas wells. They actually drilled into the trash and they are extracting out the gas. And then you go over to number three, and at number three, we actually destroy that gas. So we burn it. There are two ways that we burn it at Regen. One is through a landfill gas flare. That is just pure heat. We just burn it like it's on your stovetop. It's just larger. The second is we produce 5 megawatts of power. So we have four engines. They produce 5 megawatts of power. We use about 1 megawatt on site for our operations. And then the other four get put out into the grid where it can be used by the community. So that's considered a renewable energy source. The wells, go ahead. Yeah, thank you. So the landfill gas wells, which are these straws that I told you about that are getting drilled into, they're designed to collect the waste, the waste gas. Down below you, on the left-hand side, you see the waste. And then you also see the straw, the well, which is drilled in, has a pipe that's put into it. That gravel around rock or gravel backfill, that's to allow for air to be able to come in. Then there's a pipe that goes in. That pipe has a bunch of holes in it to be able to pull in the gas. And then that top of that is sealed to make sure that nothing can escape out. And then we apply a vacuum to it and follow the arrows. The gas comes up out of the landfill well, goes into a pipe system where the vacuum is pulling it in and taking it to those destruction devices, both the flare and the engines. The left-hand side is a cartoon. The right-hand side is actually a well in action. So you're looking at waste that's been covered by soil, and then you see the well sticking up. And I'll point you to kind of that 90-degree intersection, that yellow piece, because we're going to zoom in right now. And that's a zoom in of the well itself. We call this the wellhead. At the wellhead, we have a number of sampling ports where we could test the gas quality, how much methane is included, how we test what temperature the well is at, and we also measure the vacuum. You see that on the left-hand side, there's a manual adjustment valve. That's going to be key in this discussion, because when we extract the gas, we're able to tune in the well vacuum pressure. Okay, so we can pull harder on the well to pull out more gas, or we can pull softer on the well. Why wouldn't you just pull 100%? Because if you pull too hard, you can actually get air intrusion into the waste, and that can start an underground fire in the waste. So we have to be very delicate in how we adjust that valve to make sure we're pulling at just the right valve setting, vacuum setting. Next. And we're actually required to go to these wells every month. So monthly, we are going to these wells per the regulations that are in place. We go to these wells to inspect them. We go to these wells, next bullet. We go to these wells to measure the quality of the gas. We're checking for how much methane's in there. We're checking for how much oxygen, carbon dioxide, and then balance gas is just all the stuff left over. We measure the vacuum pressure to make sure that it's pulling out the at the right rate. Also the temperature. If we do see a higher temperature, it could be an indication that there's oxygen being in getting into the landfill and creating a thermal event. So we monitor that every month. And then somebody will go up there and actually adjust that well setting. So you remember that well setting I mentioned earlier. Next one. Each month, we go to about 100 of these wells that are on the landfill. And it can take about 2 days to accomplish just one round, one visit per month. And that's really what this new system is going to solve. We're going there once a month right now. The new system that we've just got approval from our board will enable us to do all these things every 3 hours. So that's a big game changer in how you can monitor what the gas levels coming out of the landfill are, how you can manage emissions from the landfill, and it is going above and beyond what the compliance regulations are telling us we have to do. So we're really proud of it. I'm really proud of the board for. And Wendy, Director Askew, is on our board and really proud of our board for taking this step forward. Here you can see how large the landfill actually is. Each one of those dots represents a well. And you can see just sheer size. Our administration building is kind of on the left-hand side there. If I had a pointer, I would point to it, but it's that large building kind of in the middle, it's about 100,000 square foot built MRF, material recovery facility. So it's a big piece of land. And we visit each one of these wells each month, and that keeps us in compliance. That makes the regulators, such as this body, check a box and say we're doing what we're supposed to do. In the last 2 years, we've had a number of researchers at our facility, and I'm really proud of us again because we are not closing our doors. We're allowing research to happen at our facility. We've had UC Berkeley, who's doing a study there now. UC Davis is also doing a study at our landfill. We've had conversations with Carbon Mapper, which is a satellite-based emissions monitoring system. And we've also talked with California Air Resources Board about what we're doing here, sharing the results. And Carbon Mapper is a somewhat newer tool. It's been in the works for a number of years. And what it does is they've launched satellites into space, and they can measure where entities have leaks in their systems. So what you're looking at here is actually ReGen's landfill. And you see that blue blob coming out of it, that is actually a plume of methane that is escaping from the landfill. And so, like I mentioned before, we are in compliance. However, research is showing, and the new technology that's available is showing that there is still emissions coming from the landfill. And this is where this new system comes in. It has a funny name, it's called LOCI. It is a company that really started out a number of years ago in various landfills who were interested in doing renewable natural gas creation. And we've been monitoring them for a number of years and been interested, but the price point was not there. The technology wasn't quite there for us to dive in. So we launched a pilot study of the LOCI system. Pass that one. And the pilot study began with a very small amount. We have 100 wells, but we only put the system on 20 of the wells. It was supposed to last for about 12 months, but we came to the conclusion the system works. It's generating more collection of landfill gas. The system functions well. It has a user interface. And so after 6 months, we asked them for a proposal. We were ready to move forward. We weren't going to learn anything more from the pilot. It looks very similar on the left picture. You see what we saw earlier. You see the well coming out of the ground. You see the well head. You see the sample ports. And the LOCI system is everything to the left of that red hose. There's a solar to provide power. There's a gas analyzer. It's connected to the cloud, the internet. And it has calibration gases on it. And so imagine these all over the landfill at 100 different place locations, giving us data on the landfill, telling us how it's living, how it's breathing, what parts of the landfill are producing more than others. And the pilot showed really early on that it was gonna collect more gas. If you think about us going there every month and measuring the gas quality and volumes, to go into every 3 hours and being able to change the valve position every 3 hours, you're talking about a lot of control where we, you know, temperature, high pressure system comes in. It's gonna change how much gas gets emitted from the landfill. Low pressure system, it's really literally is breathing in and out even at nighttime as the temperature drops. So we're able to capture and react to that change now. And that, those two lines show about 120 standard cubic feet. That's about 15% more gas collection in those wells where it was installed, which is significant. And I mentioned the amount. In the 7 month period, it ended up being 340 metric tons for just the of CH4 that was reduced, which has the methane, carbon dioxide equivalent of 9,500, and it eliminated the annual emissions of 2,000 internal combustion passenger vehicles. So that's just 15% on those 20 wells only. So this is where we got excited about the potential. Next one. So the agreement that we've executed at the board has authorized us to implement has been 90 controllers at a cost of $788,000. It includes everything above. And we feel that this is a value that we can deliver to the community and in a number of ways. And I'll go over those in a second. I'll go next one. This is the interface, what it looks like. You can click into these wells and see the gas quality. You see AV22, that's a named well. You see it's running at 53.4 methane, CH4 is methane, 42.8 carbon dioxide. And you can actually adjust the valve position from your desk. So if I don't like what I'm seeing here, if I see that temperature is too high, from my desk, I can remotely change the valve position. And that's huge. In bad weather, in just trekking out there, walking out there, finding and making an adjustment, then seeing how it reacts, it just adds so much more capabilities to our management of the system. And you can see this map again showing the purple wells, which were the pilot system, and the yellow wells, which are now going to be receiving this. So it's actually a significant number of wells that it's going to be installed on. Benefits to the community. If we project that 15% increase in gas collection, we're talking about 13,000 internal combustion passenger vehicles. That's about the size of every car in Pacific Grove. We're eliminating those from the streets every year. And it has a big impact. We're reducing odor potential that the landfill could create, because at nighttime we do have this fluctuation of the gas and the pressures. So there is a chance at nighttime it's producing more emissions than otherwise. So this system, now that it's able to fine tune every 3 hours, it's going to be collecting more gas. Less gas emitted, less means less odors for the community. We're proud that we're implementing it ahead of the regulations. It's something that's really important to Regen, is to be on the forefront and implement these things. So we don't want to just be compliant, because that's the bare minimum. We want to do what we can to improve the situation. It's also a really great thing for the research. The people at UC Berkeley, at UC Davis, they've had their research happen before we've implemented this system, and now they're going to have it after. So they can look at a before and after, which is just going to improve the knowledge of the world. And I already mentioned that one. There's also a potential that carbon offset credits could be gained by the industry. As we are reducing emissions in our facility, we may be able to make some carbon credits available to other industry. And benefits to Regen are benefits to all of us. What Regen does to control emissions and compliance, it benefits our air, it benefits my work environment that I'm in every day, and all of our constituents that we serve. There's also going to be a number of improvements we expect on our engine performance. Now that we're being able to produce better gas, we're able to run those engines a little bit better. We're also able to think about expansion of that power production. And now that we have more gas, we have more possibilities in how we can expand that system. The real-time monitoring adds a lot of early warning signs, which we would not be able to know with the one-month interval. And we're able to optimize and do things on the fly from our desk. And then we'll start building a database of information that we can use to make better decisions. I've already mentioned there's possibilities to expand the electricity generation. There's also possibility that we may be able to produce renewable natural gas as well with the additional volumes. So now that we're able to know how much we can really get out of this, out of the landfill, we can start talking to different companies about what kind of use we can put that gas to. And as I mentioned before, making the carbon credits available to the community also could mean more revenue for Regen to pay off the investment that we've made here. And so with that, I know I went a little fast, but I know you have a long agenda, so I wanted to be respectful of that. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions through the chair.
Yes, in case it's not lost on you, chair and board members, the reason they are here today is because we regulate the emissions from the landfill, which is obvious, but we greatly appreciate their leadership in this area and in the state of California. We currently also act on behalf of CARB to inspect the facility for greenhouse gas emissions. And this will be, as David said, go greatly to over compliance, which we like to see. And so we're really excited about this opportunity and really appreciate this forward-looking next steps. And we're also looking forward to working with them as the system comes online and is expanded. So this is really good news and should be trumpeted to the public. And I know you guys are going to make a good effort to do that, but this is really outstanding example of what public service can do. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go to public comment quick before we do board comments, questions.
No hands raised online, nothing received, and no one in the board.
All right, back to the board for questions or comments.
What's the capacity of the methane storage? Is there like a capacity for the storage of the methane? And is it able to power or energize, I guess, or power the entire operations there?
It is able to power the operation. So we also operate a material recovery facility, so all the blue bin recycling goes to our facility where we sort it out. You know, we tell you put the plastic bottles, the cans, all net in there, and we actually sort it out. All our operations use 1 megawatt of power. Our power plant produces 5, so it does produce a significant amount of energy. And then to your earlier question, as far as how much capacity does the landfill have for gas, or how much is total getting produced?
Storage of gas, yeah.
Storage, so we don't like to store the gas. If we start storing gas, it could create a bubble in the landfill, and then that bubble can explode or it can pop and make emissions. That's exactly why we're penetrating it with those wells and extracting that gas out as fast as we want to be pulling it out as fast as the landfill is making it. And so we don't store it there. It goes straight into destruction.
Director Askew, Director LeBert.
Okay. Really liking the presentation. Very, very interesting. Just a couple of clarification questions. So on the energy production, the 5 kilowatts, megawatts. Is that hourly, daily, or annual?
Megawatts are instantaneous. So it's just a measure of instantaneous power that it can produce.
You're not, I guess what I mean, you're not running 24 hours a day.
Oh, we are, yeah.
Okay, so you're megawatt hours. So you're producing 5 per hour every day. That's amazing. That's where I'm getting to. It's that production, right?
Right, producing power, we want to be producing power 24/7. It's we're burning.
But you are doing that now.
Yes, we are. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
And so then you would, and then the expansion that you talked about, the 90 additional of the upgrades, the 15% increase in gas was calculated on the current upgrades, or is that you extrapolated to what is fully in place?
Yeah, we extrapolated from the pilot. From the pilot, we saw an 18% increase, but we are being a little conservative and saying and thinking we're going to get 15%. That'll be proofed out by what we're able to, once we have the system fully implemented. The technicians are there right now starting this installation, and so it's coming into play where we'll be able to give real numbers to how much gas we're extracting. But the pilot was extremely successful.
And so I would imagine my last question is you're anticipating additional, roughly another 15% growth in electricity output as well.
It doesn't work that way because our plant is set in how much power it can produce. Right now, about 50% of the gas can go to power production. The other 50% is flared. So the increase in gas will be going to the flare. And so it opens up opportunities for us to expand our electricity generation if that's where we want to go. Or it also opens opportunities for renewable natural gas. So there's more business potential, more beneficial reuse that we can get if we can extract more gas.
I'm sorry, I got to ask one more because this really is very, very interesting to me. And so I think right now it's about 2 to 3 million a megawatt hour for the production cost for each to increase the electricity production, or is it more into the 5 million per megawatt hour?
For us to produce?
To expand. So you said you're capped right now at 5 megawatts an hour, but because you're putting 50% through just flaring it out, you actually could, if you had the capital, you could add another, to get another 5 going on.
We could, yeah.
And that's running about anywhere about 3 to 5 million per megawatt hour for construction, I would imagine.
That's a more nuanced conversation about what the engines cost and infrastructure, but I mean, in short, it can be expanded whether we go with engines or we go with RNG. That's the business decision that Regen needs to make in the board. We're going to be bringing to the board because one molecule of methane may have more value in one use than the other.
And the reason it's important is my city, we're 8 megawatts an hour. That's our use. So this is really exciting because you're producing almost everything that we would use for all everything. Awesome. Thank you, Jeff.
They're asking you.
All right. I just want to say this is the second time I've heard this particular presentation, and I'm sitting on the board of Regen. One example of the type of really out of the box, innovative thinking, looking to the future type of work that both the staff, the leadership team, and really the board, the entire board is pushing for and wants to see happening. Having the regulatory oversight of MBARD, sort of here to say, like, keep the pressure on. I think it's a good pressure to have, and it's a good dynamic to have in place. So I want to say it's nice to sit sort of in both places and to see the interplay. But to the point that I know that I came this morning from a presentation over at the Monterey High School with the NAHAL students who are, the students thinking about, how do we protect our environment, how do we protect our oceans, and how do we think about protecting and mitigating the climate change impact. And the questions that they were struggling with were, how do you make these investments in ways that they have real impact? But the one question that we're always looking at is return on investment. And sometimes that return on investment isn't so direct. And in this case, $800,000 to capture methane gas, with the return on investment being that methane gas just simply isn't going into our environment. Without that direct, immediate return on investment, but doing it because it's the right thing to do. And then we are having those conversations about, what comes next, what are the best options, but knowing that these are the right decisions to be making as we move in the right direction collectively is really exciting. And to your point, Rich, we need to be telling this story, and we need to be letting the public know that this is what I think they're telling us they want, and we are using our public infrastructure to continue pushing collectively in the right direction. So I just want to say thank you for the work and give some credit where credit's due to the board for continually pushing. They may not have all the technical details. I loved your questions, Mike, but they know that we're headed down a path, and we need to keep diligently and aggressively pursuing a path to capture that gas, reduce emissions, and ultimately reduce what we're putting in the landfill where we set it at Regen. We need to deal with what shows up in the door, and then at Embark, we get to make sure that we're pushing to have reduced emissions the best possible. But thank you.
Thank you. Richard DeServa.
Hi. And so I'm new to all this sanitation kind of stuff, so I'm sorry if these questions are elementary. But so I know in many landfills, et cetera, there's PFAS and other bad things in there.
Yeah.
So what I understand is in that you destroy the methane and the other gases that are coming through a flare. That's one megawatt, and then the other four you're using into the pushing into the grid. But to do that, you're also essentially destroying it, correct?
Right.
So you're burning it off.
Correct.
So what is the environmental impact to some of these, to the destruction of the gas? Like, what are
That's
we
a great
pushing
question.
Into the environment at That's this a, point?
A great question. And to answer it properly, we have to talk about the greenhouse gas impact of methane itself. We're talking about a gas that is 25 times more potent than CO2. So we do generate some emissions from our engines, from our flare, which are regulated through source tests, which are regulated through monitoring of those emissions. Those emissions are far less impactful than if the burning did not happen. So if we don't destroy the methane, it's 25 times worse. If we do destroy the methane, we have 98% destruction capabilities with burning it. By destroying it, we do produce some CO2.
So I understand the benefits, but what is going up in the destruction? So what are we looking at? What are the byproducts of burning off the methane?
Oh, you're looking at CO2, NOx, SOx, particulates. There's a whole list which is included in our permits and regulated through our permits to not exceed the allowable thresholds. So there's a whole host of emissions that are coming out.
And are you just burning 24 hours then?
Yeah.
So it's just constantly going in. Okay.
Right.
Thank
Correct.
You.
So if I may step in, since it is a permitting issue, the Air District permits those emissions. And we do an evaluation, an engineering evaluation up front to determine what those emissions are, what the quantities are, and what the impacts on the environment. And we do our best to make sure they're using what's called best available control technology to reduce to the extent possible impacts of those emissions and the emissions themselves. So that's one of the principal duties and responsibilities of this agency is to make sure that anything that goes into the environment does not have an adverse impact on the environment or public health.
So I grew up in Salinas, even though I'm on the board in Santa Cruz, and I know that the wind comes through Marina and just rips through the valley. So I'm guessing that all of these emissions are in general heading over the east, over Salinas, et cetera.
So
are we monitoring all of that?
We are. We actually send a lot of emissions down to San Luis Obispo. And we also receive a lot of emissions from the Bay Area and San Joaquin Valley. About 60% of our air quality problem is due to emissions from our neighbors to the north and to the east. So it's a complex issue, but they're doing the exact same thing we're doing up there. Plus, by the time anything gets to San Luis Obispo, it's pretty diluted. So the impacts would be significantly less from where they're generated.
Any other questions or comments? None. Supervisor Alejo, do you have anything?
None. Thank you for the presentation.
I'd just like to thank you for that presentation. I mean, it was really thought out. I learned a bunch of things through you to your presentation. And I know Watsonville also has their site alongside the county, so I'm going to test them to see what we're doing, because I want to be also innovating like you guys are. So just thank you and to all that hard work.
And then I would just add, I'm from San Diego County, and we have a landfill situation that's in flux. Just, is this a fairly conventional technology and software? Is it proprietary? Can you steal it from you?
We're putting up a fence pretty soon, so we're not going to allow that to happen. Well, the technology is available. It's been available for a few years. It's really the price tag that puts a lot of people off because its cost. In the long run, there may be some carbon credits that may become available that would offset some of those costs. And we're making those applications as we speak to the regulators to get those carbon credits. And we're pretty optimistic about it. So if they tie turns on this system being allowed to be used in that carbon credit market, you're going to see it become a lot more economical to implement. If that gets to your question.
Well, a question about the carbon credits, because I sat through a presentation at Farm Bureau recently where farmers could actually make some adjustments on their properties, earn carbon credits, and then sell them for a lot of money, like $1,500 a credit or more, $6,000 a credit sometimes, to bigger companies like AI companies and this and that. Is that something that you're planning on the future, is being able to sell the credits for some type of profit?
It opens up the possibility for us. We'll obviously need to go to our board to get anything like that approved. And this is one of the things we didn't have that as a large part of the conversation when we took it to our board, because we felt this technology stood on its own. And so when we do get this company, LOCI, does end up getting a carbon credit approval, we would bring something like that to our board for discussion on, as if that's something we want to entertain going into.
Hearing none, I would just, anything else we can do to promote new outreach on this very positive work that's being done certainly would be a good thing for the community. And that would take us to our next item, 21, receive presentation on calendar year 2024 engineering and compliance activities. Amy Climo.
So good afternoon, directors. I'm Amy Climo. I'm the engineering and compliance manager, and I'll just give a brief update of the report that's in your agenda packet today. So first, I'll just briefly describe what we do in engineering compliance and then go over some of the highlights of the activity data from the report. So in engineering, the primary responsibility is issuing permits, as Richard said, for sources like the landfill. And so our engineers write that engineering evaluation report, and they look at federal, state, and local regulations as they apply to what's in the application. They'll issue a permit with operating conditions. And then some other activities we do is we may develop rules and regulations, either develop a new rule or revise an existing rule. And then we also do report annual emission inventory data to the state. So this is just an overview of the permit process, which is the main activity that our engineers do. So they'll be assigned an application. And as I mentioned, I'll do an engineering evaluation, which is a several page report where they review the emissions from that application and then go through all of the different rules that apply to that piece of equipment and then make a decision about whether or not that equipment will comply. And if they find that that meets all of our requirements, then they'll issue something called an authority to construct. And that tells the person they can go ahead and install that equipment. It meets all the air quality regulations. And then once that is installed, then they'll go out and do a startup inspection to make sure the person actually installed what they said they were going to install. Once they confirm that, they'll come back and they'll write up the permit to operate with all those conditions to make sure that they stay in compliance with the air quality regulations. So this is just a highlight of some of our activity data from 2024. So we received 286 applications, and that was down from 2023. So that resulted in the next category, our authorities to construct, were also down a little bit from 2023. We also had some staffing changes. We had an engineer leave, and then we refilled that position. And so we did have some downtime there. And then we did 132 startup inspections. That was pretty much equivalent to 2023. And then we issued 220 permits to operate, which was also equivalent to 2023. So our activity for 2024 is about what we expect. This is just a pie chart showing the types of permits that were issued last year. And as you'll see in the two blue pieces of the pie, the main categories we had were miscellaneous, which is lots of different kinds of equipment. It might be a soil remediation project. It might be a dry cleaner, an aggregate crushing. kind of a catch-all bucket for things that don't fit in the other categories. And then the dark blue one is change of ownership. So we get a lot of, typically happens with gas stations, they change owners. So we need to reissue the permit to the new owner. And then the other two categories, emergency engines, we had about 50 of those. As we've had power losses during storms and such, we continue to see more people applying to have a backup engine in case the power goes out. So once that permit to operate is issued, it moves over to our compliance team, and our inspectors conduct inspections of the equipment that's on those permits. They make sure that the permit holder is following the conditions and doing the record keeping they're supposed to be doing. And in some occasions, we do have to take enforcement action and issue violations if someone is not doing what their permit's telling them they should be doing. We do also ensure compliance with the federal asbestos regulation, and that's a regulation for renovation and demolition of commercial, industrial type facilities. They need to remove asbestos before they can demolish a building, or if they're removing a load-bearing structure, they will also have to notify us. And then we also respond to complaints. Next. So this is a highlight of some of the activities on the compliance side. And this year was the first year where we really had full staff of inspectors. So we were able to get out and do 1,900 inspections last year, which is really great. We have about 3,185 permits. So we were able to get out to more than half of those permits last year. So we're really excited we were able to do that last year. Did receive 296 of those asbestos notifications that I mentioned. And then we have one inspector that does the inspections for those projects. And we were able to do 267 of those. And we had four variance orders issued, and that comes from our hearing board, which Richard mentioned earlier. We're looking for a medical professional or engineer, and then source tests observed. So the inspectors will go out, and as Regen had mentioned, they have to do source tests on their flare and engine. So our inspectors will go out during a third party comes out and does the testing, and then our inspector will be there just to kind of see what's going on and make sure if they notice anything, they may say something. So this is just an example of the types of complaints we received last year. And far above all, we got 45% of those were odor complaints. Typically, it's some of them are coming from residents of Marina because they are so close in proximity to the landfill. There's a wastewater treatment plant there, composting operation, then they're separated by ag fields. And then dust and smoke are the next two most popular categories. We do get some smoke from outdoor fires, but then also a lot of chimney smoke complaints, particularly in the San Lorenzo Valley in Santa Cruz County. And this is just kind of the 10-year activity trends, just to take a look at, you know, how is our workload over the past 10 years. So the top bar is just the total number of permits. You can see it's been pretty steady, maybe a slight increase in the past 10 years. The middle blue bar is just the number of compliance inspections, and you can see we're on an upward trajectory since 2022. And that's really heavily reliant on staffing, and that's why I said we're really excited. Last year we had a full staff inspector, so we could really get out there and do our inspections. And then the bottom three lines are the number of complaints, the number of permits issued, the number of permit applications received. And it's just an indication we do have this steady workload for our engineers and our inspectors over the last 10 years. So we don't see any need to do any staffing changes because we have a steady workload. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Public comment first.
No hands raised online, nothing received, and no one in the boardroom.
Great, back to the board for questions and comments.
So the 45% of our complaints was a representative in the district and the landfill and the more than water being there. Has that been steady over time? Is that increasing over time? I know we've invested time and money and resources and trying to get our arms around what's actually going on with that. Are we seeing any improvement?
I think we unfortunately, we did just have a spike this month. I think it was January 4th, we got like 10 complaints, 9 or 10 complaints all on that same one Saturday. So that was the first time since, I don't know if you remember back like 2018, they used to have a biodigester out there. That was the last time where we got like a large number of complaints on one day. But we have seen since that time, not the same level of volume of complaints on the same day. Maybe one person will call in. So the event that happened on January 4th was the first time we've seen that. So I would say we have seen improvement, except I'm not quite sure what happened on that one day. Yeah.
Anything else on the board, Supervisor Director of Alejo?
None, thank you.
Director DeSerpa?
On the slide that showed the graph, I noticed on the green line is permits issued, but that is less than permit much less than permit applications. Can you explain that?
Sure. So by regulation, when we get a permit application, we're supposed to issue the authority to construct in 180 days. So that means an application could come in July and we don't even issue the authority to construct till 6 months later, which could be January the next year. And so it's not, permits aren't necessarily issued the same year they're received because we have that intermediate step to do the authority to construct within 180 days of getting that application.
Thank you very much. This is just another one of those snapshots that shows the immense amount of workload that this agency has. Again, so thank you, staff, thank you for the presentation. That would take us to item 22, that would be receive presentation on calendar year 2024 planning division activities. And we have David Frisbee.
Good afternoon, Chairman Kosmicki, members of the board. I'm here to give you an update on our planning activities for 2024. So what does planning do? Well, traditionally we were required to develop air quality plans. So when we have an excess of ozone, let's say in the atmosphere, we make plans to reduce it over time as population increases. So that was their main thing we've been tasked to do. We've attained the ozone standard, so we no longer are required to do air quality plans for reducing ozone. We also administer grant programs, which I'll dive deeply into in a minute, because we do a lot of grant programs. That's kind of our bread and butter now. We review CEQA documents. Last year, we reviewed 22 mitigated negative declarations and environmental impact reports. We administer our smoke management program for large prescribed fires and backyard burning and agricultural burning. We also do public outreach and education to promote our programs, and we do special projects, and I'll get into that in a minute. So we have a number of grant programs. We have our programs that replace equipment, old dirty equipment, for new or cleaner burning equipment. Our main three programs, Carl Moyer Program, Farmer Program, Community Air Protection, those are all funded by grant from CARB that come to us, and then we pass them through to the community. AB 2766 and AB 923 are fees that we collect from the registration of vehicles in the region. So we collect $4 for each vehicle, and then actually up to $6 for each vehicle registered in the region, and then we pass that through for grants. With stove changeout program is funded by a grant from the Air Resources Board. So AB 2766, our motor vehicle emission reduction program. This is where we promote programs that reduce emissions from transportation projects. In past years, we've done development of roundabouts and adaptive traffic signal controls. Last few years, we've focused more on electrification of medium duty vehicles. In this case, this is the city of Santa Cruz's refuse hauler. This was our first refuse hauler that we funded. On the left, you'll see the old refuse hauler. That's a diesel engine, it's dirty. That's at now at A&S Metals. It's just about to get destroyed in that picture. On the right, you'll see the new refuse hauler. Doesn't look much different, except for you'll see that it's plugged in there to charge the battery. Our AB2766 program, we've got electric vehicle, also has an electric vehicle incentive program where we incentivize the purchase of electric vehicles. Last year, we did 230 purchases of electric vehicles at ranging from $1,500 for a brand new electric vehicle, and we've doubled those amounts for low-income applicants. The picture on the right is a testimonial of a couple that would not have been able to get into an electric vehicle because they are seniors living on fixed income. So these are the types of people that would like to help get into electric vehicles. The Assembly Bill 923, the $2 off of each vehicle in the region, that goes towards projects like electric vehicle infrastructure. In this case, we have a zero emission school bus program where we provide funding to purchase a new electric bus for schools in the region. In this case, the city of Santa Cruz purchased a Type A electric school bus for $174,000. Our Carl Moore Memorial Grant Program, essentially it replaces diesel-powered equipment with the older dirty equipment with newer, cleaner burning equipment. So on the left, you'll see a old diesel tractor, tier zero, really dirty. In the middle, you'll see it destroyed. That's at A&S Metals. It just gets destroyed and recycled. And then we contributed, in this case, in this picture, $53,895 towards the purchase of that tractor. We did 21 projects last year. That's up from last year quite a bit. I think double from last year. We granted $2.5 million, and we have an emission reduction of 64.8 tons per year, which will continue year to year until these units wear out, essentially. We launched our landscape equipment exchange program and at the end of 2023. This program is essentially the same as the other programs. If you take an old, dirty piece of equipment and you destroy it, and you get a portion of the funding, the purchase price of a new electric, not plug-in, battery-powered, piece of landscape equipment. So we have a residential program and a commercial program. Last year we did 158 exchanges for the residential program, spent $50,000. And the commercial program did 105 exchanges. That's just customers. That's not the total amount of equipment. So each of the commercial applicants get a number of different pieces of equipment exchanged. And so we've granted $153,000 for that program as well. Farmer program, essentially it's the same as the Carl Moyer program. You take an old tractor, you destroy it. That's the middle picture, and then you've got a brand new tractor. It's similar program, different fund. So last year we did another 10 projects, awarded about $1 million, and we've got a continuous annualized emission reduction of 23.5 tons per year. Our community air protection program started 2021. We are focusing the funds, we're required to focus the funds in disadvantaged communities and low-income areas in the region. We have been pretty successful in directing all the funding to disadvantaged communities since we started the program. So we're proud of that. Those are the areas of Marina, South and Eastern Salinas, and Pajaro and part of Watsonville. Those are the three disadvantaged community areas in our region. We completed four projects last year, awarded $824,000, and are achieving 7.1 tons of emissions reductions per year. This is, I thought this was a fun picture because this just shows how A&S Metals destroys the the buses and the tractors. They have these big shears that just really grind into the old dirty equipment, and to render it useless. So we make sure that those emissions are completely unavailable. So wood stove changeout program is, again, it's an exchange program. You take an old wood stove or open hearth fireplace, as you see on the left, that gets removed and destroyed, and an updated wood-burning fireplace is, we contribute towards that, the purchase, $2,500 towards a new wood-burning fireplace or pellet stove or electric heater or a heat pump, a ducted mini-split heat pump. Last year we accomplished awarding all of the funds that we had available to us, 130 changeouts. We're in the process of the spending or obligating the rest of the funds that we received from Ventura in January. So the project's continuing. We received an extra $75,000 from Ventura County, and that program is probably going to be done here within a month. So we're really moving through the funds and getting a lot of changeouts out there. This is our distribution of wood stove installations. You see that most of the installations are up in Santa Cruz County. People living up in the forest, they have a readily available wood source and source of fuel available to them. So it's a popular program up there in the San Lorenzo Valley, which is also happens to be one of our higher concentrations of PM2.5 during the winter months when we have a strong inversion setting up, and we see higher concentrations of PM2.5 from wood stoves and wood smoke from open burning. We also manage our smoke management program. We issue permits for prescribed burning, agricultural burning, and backyard burns. We have issued 57 prescribed fire smoke management permits last year, 107 ag burn permits, and 1,275 backyard burn permits. The ag burn permits is artificially low because Cal Fire does a lot of the permitting for us. If Cal Fire issues a permit, then we don't issue a permit because there's no purpose in duplicating the process. So it cuts the red tape on open burning. With prescribed burning, we get actively involved with the land managers and the fire agencies that conduct the prescribed fire, so that we make sure that they're burning on days that are meteorologically favorable for dispersion of the smoke. So we want to make sure that when the smoke is, you're going to get smoke from fire, there's no way around that. But if they do it on a day that's really good for dispersion, the real unstable atmosphere gets the smoke up and out of the area, that's what we're after. So we've got a good working relationship with a lot of the burners in the region. The top picture you'll see there is an ag burn. We see a lot of the ag burning. That's pretty routine. And then on the bottom there, it's backyard burn. Typical backyard burn we'll see in the Santa Cruz Mountains, for instance. I think I took that 20 years ago when I was an inspector. That's what we see. A distribution of our prescribed fires, you'll see, as you would expect, in the mountainous areas, Santa Cruz Mountains, the Gavilan Range, and the Santa Lucia Range is where we see most of our prescribed burning. We get involved in a lot of special projects. We've got San Lorenzo Valley Spare the Air program, where we watch the weather conditions and make sure that people are going to ask to not use wood burning devices to heat their homes when we've got a strong inversion layer in the San Lorenzo Valley. So we're in the middle of that program right now. We also get involved with air quality forecasting. So you'll see on our website, we forecast what the air quality will be for the next week. We've gotten recently, this past year, we got involved with Blue Whales and Blue Skies, which is a program to reduce the speed of shipping along the California coast to reduce emissions. But it also has the benefit of slowing the ships down so that if they do hit a whale, they're not going to be damaging to the whales. So they're approaching trying to reduce the speed of the shipping to less than 10 knots. We also received a grant from CAPCOA for clean air centers. As you see in that box sitting there in the right-hand picture is a air filtration system that we are working with the Breathe California, which is a nonprofit organization here in California, and the offices of emergency services for all three counties to help establish a clean air center. So if there's a wildfire, people will have an area, a location where they can come in, escape the wildfire smoke. So we're hopefully, if there is an impact, hopefully there's not any impacts this year, but if there is, then we'll help the OESs establish clean air centers in the region. That, I do want to say that running through the grant programs like this does not give any idea of how involved and how much effort it takes to actually set up a program like that. And then the processing of the applications that comes through is a huge effort. So I've got to really hand it to my staff who does a tremendous job of getting these applications processed and out. That'll take questions.
Do you have any public comment?
Nothing online, no hands in the boardroom.
Any comments, questions from the board?
Yes. Turbo? Yes, this one, and I'll direct this probably to a bridge. So I was visiting right up in Santa Cruz Mountains, and they were doing this dry burns, but they had some type of bombs that they would burn the materials, and there was a covered box, which so that I believe they said that they do have to come to inward for a permit and do that. So
we would like them to we know that Cal Fire has been operating these devices. They're called air curtain incinerators, and they're designed to minimize smoke, but there still are significant emissions from these, just less smoke impacts if done properly. And that's the big question. Basically, they have a fan that recirculates the air, the smoke, so that it gets burned and the particulate gets burned, but still have gases, still have finer particulates that are emitted. And these things are huge sources of emissions. But we don't have a lot of options. Prescribed burn, the fire department would like to be burning 365 days a year, 24/7. And they would burn right up to our threshold for our air quality standards, which would make this a living nightmare. You couldn't see across the street and so forth. So it's a challenge right now for us, but those do reduce smoke. We'd like to see them used. We like them to come talk to us first. We found out sort of after the fact that Cal Fire had 9 of these operating in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and they did not tell us about them. So that's a problem. There's been problem with permitting to whether or not they're what's called an air operating permit or a Title V source, because they can easily emit more than 100 tons of pollutants in you know, just a week's time. So yeah, they're a problem, but they're also a potential solution. And we're trying to work with the burners as well as the fire departments to make sure that we're notified so they're done correctly. We even had a landfill that wanted to put one in their landfill to burn materials that were coming in the landfill, which is totally illegal. So that cannot happen. But I think as forestry management becomes the popular flavor of the day, we're going to see more pressure on governmental entities to start permitting these things.
Do we have any other comments or questions? Director DeServa?
So these are great programs, these grant programs. Can you talk a little bit about the outreach that you're doing to any of these audiences?
Right. Well, we have to, as part of the grant for the Community Air Protection Program, for example, the Air Resources Board requires us to do outreach in disadvantaged communities. So we do outreach in the form of workshops, advertising on radio in Spanish, print media, social media, do a lot of pushing out on that. We do Earth Day outreach and write and drive events as well.
Like to specific school districts, are you doing actual outreach to the superintendent or to the transportation? Because, you know, it's on the board for Pajaro Valley 14 years, and I don't remember, like, I didn't see Pajaro Valley on your list at all of any of the grantees.
We do a lot of cold calling just to the transportation agencies and try to build relationships there. Rich has reached out to superintendents, cold called them, and they, you know, just let them know about our programs. It's sometimes hard to get, you know, the schools are very busy, as you know. They all have jobs, and so to ask them to apply for a grant is something extra on top of what they do. And then, so we do get some reluctance to apply from school districts. So, but we do actually try to get to the right person that's going to champion the project. If you find somebody, then they move forward with them.
Thank you very much. And thanks for the presentation. That would take us to item 24, report from Air Pollution, or 23, receive presentation on calendar 2024.
Good afternoon, Board of Directors. I'm Sean Boyle. I'm the Air Monitoring and Planning Supervisor here at MBARD, here to give you the 2024 State of the Air Quality Report. And if I could sum up our air quality for 2024 in one word, it'd be fortunate. And the reason why I say that, it's not because we have some of the best air quality in the state of California, if not the nation and the world. The reason why I say fortunate is California was on fire last year. Majority of the state was impacted by wildfire smoke. We were lucky that we weren't impacted with that smoke. So the three counties, Monterey, San Benito, Santa Cruz counties, we formed the North Central Coast Air Basin. And within that air basin, we have an air monitoring network of instruments we run based on state and federal standards. So here's what some of the instruments look like. They look pretty unassuming. They look like they should be on a movie set almost. We have dedicated staff that makes these things work, make sure that the networks are running, that they're calibrated, they're highly sophisticated. And even when we're not on the clock, we're always working. We're making sure these things are running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So we get a lot of calls. You're the air district, test the air. I wish it was as easy as that. You know, air is kind of a soup of kind of a lot of stuff. So you kind of have to know what you're testing for. So CARB and EPA have developed a criteria pollutants and kind of what they're looking for based on medical and scientific studies, as well as secondary human welfare aspects. And MBARD, the three criteria pollutants, we kind of focus on our ozone and two sizes of particulate matter, which is PM10 and 2.5. So here's a map of kind of where our air monitoring stations are located. We have 8 monitoring stations, 6 of them run ozone. The one at Pinnacles National Park is run by the National Park Service. 6 stations measure PM2.5 and 3 stations measure PM10. All the data collected from these stations are put onto our website. It's for the public or the community to access at any time. Look at the air quality index, see what's going on in their neighborhood. Examples of kind of what the air monitoring stations look like. The instrumentation I just showed you before are housed in these structures. The one on the left is Carmel Valley. The one on the right is our new station in San Lorenzo Valley School. We had to move the station last year due to construction. So I'm going to jump into the data from what we collected last year. So just kind of a reminder, little cheat sheet of what ozone is. It's a oxidant gas that's strong. You know, it's a mixture of nitrous oxides and VOCs, a chemical reaction in sunlight and heat. So usually ozone season is summertime, right? More sunlight, more heat. Well, you know, with wildfires kind of breaking out at any time of the year now, ozone season's kind of all year round because wildfire smoke's a precursor to ozone. So surface level ozone, you know, impacts breathing and lung capacity. But on the welfare factor, it's really important. We have a lot of agriculture going on here. So ozone also impacts crop yield and size. So it's really important to have minimal levels of ozone in our area. So we'll start off with the daily 1 hour peak ozone average, and this is the state standard. See the line right there, that's 90 parts per billion. So we were all on attainment for the 1 hour peak ozone for that. Okay, so this is the daily 8 hour peak ozone. So Monterey and Santa Cruz counties, we are in attainment for that. For San Benito County out in Pinnacles, as Rich was describing before, that's kind of our problem area for ozone because it's closer to the San Joaquin Valley as well as Bay Area. We get a lot of their kind of pollution coming down in that area. So on March 5th of last year, we had 72 parts per billion. So that was two sections over the 70 parts per billion there. So we kind of had an exceedance on that date. Okay, so this is kind of a 10-year ozone trend of both the state and federal standards for the 1 hour and 8 hour. And as you can see from 2021, we've kind of leveled out with our ozone right there. So, okay, I really like this slide because it kind of shows what we're playing with when we're talking particulate matter. So you can see the fine beach sand with the human hair. See the PM10 levels going across the human hair. That's, you know, typical dust, pollen, mold sizes right there. And then the PM2.5 model showing that it fits inside the PM10. So, you know, these are small particles that have big health impacts. You know, they get in the, they're easy to breathe in, and then they get in the bloodstream. So such, you know, kinds of illnesses you can get from certain things like this is childhood asthma or breast cancer or premature death almost. Sources of PM is like cars and agricultural operations and windblown dust and diesel engines and wildfire smoke. Here we go talking about that again. So there are PM10 standard of last year. We actually had an increase. We had 20 exceedances where it probably went up a third from it was last year. And these were all from our King City station. And these were all windblown driven events. You know, Salinas Valley, right? You know, as you were saying, gets windy certain times of year and a lot of dust gets picked up and goes down the valley there. Topography and meteorology is a big factor with this stuff. Okay, here's the 10-year trend of our PM10. As you can see, we kind of been having exceedances since for the last 10 years and even beyond. You see that spike in 2021? Well, that was a wildfire smoke event. So the PM10 monitors were even picking that up. So here's our 24-hour PM2.5. And we did really well. We had better air quality this year for 2.5 than we did last year. And you can see kind of that spike around December area. That was from the Camarillo and Malibu fires down in Southern California. We had Santa Ana winds kind of blowing the fire and the smoke towards the ocean, and the smoke went out in the ocean, curved around, and we kind of got direct impacts, but not enough for us to exceed any of the levels there. Here's the 10-year trend of our PM2.5 and the three mountains there. Those were, again, all wildfire smoke impacts that we had. The 2021, we had three fires going right at the same time. I know it looks like it's kind of skewing up there at the end, but I assure you it's under the level there. It's just kind of at the end, it kind of goes up. So I apologize for that. So we also have a smoke sensor network that we have set up in our district, and this is kind of what it looks like. It looks kind of looks like spy gear. So we got those kind of set up there, and we have 30 sensors set up in populated areas in our air district. And the data from this can be found on our website, again, for the public to access and utilize as they needed. This smoke sensor network, we're probably one of the first in the state to have this network, and it's been a really great tool for us. The data helps us, along with our monitoring data, to make air quality decision making, whether we got to do a wildfire smoke advisory for the public or a voluntary spare the air for wood burning up in San Lorenzo Valley. It's been a great tool for us, and yeah, that's pretty much it. So questions wise, is if I could sum up for, you know, coming up this year, again, I have had wildfire smoke peppered through my presentation, and that's kind of what we're anticipating again this year as the western half of the states are kind of on fire every year. So hopefully we'll get lucky and hopefully see what happens going forward this year. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Sean. Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, Chair. We've lost our quorum with Director Alejo leaving and Director Askew. So I think we should avoid questions. If you want to put out a little bit of informational items, that's fine. No more questions. And the closed session that was on, we can cover in April.
Do we have the public comment on this item yet?
No, I mean, the meeting's over. Okay. We've lost quorum.
Sounds good. So officially the meeting's adjourned, but our pollution control officer, would be okay just giving your normal report then?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board, remaining members of the board. Chris isn't the only one that got a gift today. At your chair, you should have a board member handbook. This is put out by the California Special Districts Association. We are a special district, which is different than a county, and it's different than a city. So there are some things that you should be aware of. We still follow Robert's rules, and we still follow the Brown Act. So it's nothing too technical, but there's some really great information in that. And then also you should have our bylaws. I think they get distributed. I am meeting with all the new board members to onboard them. If you're interested, we could do that, but recurring member. And then also you have a cheat sheet here of air quality terms at your chair. And so we did our best to pare this down to 2 pages. I think it was 13 pages in larger type, 14, yeah. So, there's probably some things we missed, but I picked up some things. CAPCO was mentioned, that's the California Air Pollution Control Officers Association. So if you have any questions after the presentation, please feel free to come talk to me. I do have on here to talk about the Moss Landing Power Plant. I will just say that we have spent a lot of time there, primarily myself, Sean, Amy, and David, and that's our collective brains for air quality monitoring, modeling, and toxicology. And we have a really good capacity to not be first responders, but to support work at events like this. However, we were totally overlooked. If it was not for Wendy Root Askew, we would not have been called. In fact, our website was getting hammered. We got over 200 calls when this incident first started, and the public wanted answers, and we didn't even know what was going on. So I'm happy to say, as the fire reignited yesterday, I got a call immediately, and I was kept on abreast of the situation into the early morning hours. So that's changed. We do have a lot to offer, as I said, in the field of toxicology, air quality modeling. We can run more accurate models to look at deposition and those sorts of things. I am talking to the facility right now, Vistra representatives, about establishing a network that would be essentially unmanned, but that would we could turn on when there is an event so that we could get instantaneous data on what the air quality is around the facility. They seem to be doing a really good job of monitoring the air immediately adjacent to the fire, but we're concerned about what happens once it gets off-site, and that's typically where the public lives. So we are going to be looking at funding sources. I mean, I guess the natural approach is to talk to Vistra if they want to give us some money. I think everybody's got their hand out right now, including a number of lawsuits. So if we were able to work with them and have them fund a network that we could operate, that would be really, truly great. We probably could use some of our clean air monies that we receive for fines and penalties to support this type of operation going forward. And that will be contained in our budget, reflected in our new budget. So we'll be building that in. so that we have the capacity to respond to these events. We'd also need to purchase some models and receive some additional updated training for our engineers to run those models. But I think there's a lot of room for improvement as far as the response goes. And I think we can play a critical role into helping that. And we are doing that right now. So there's a lot of misinformation that came out as well from professors and the news media in particular. And this is really scary. And we're seeing some politicization of the event as well. And so we've been talking to folks as much as we can and trying to alert people without alarming them, which I think is the function of a public servant. So anyways, we stand committed to working with the counties on addressing the fire as it's ongoing. My understanding is this is going to be a long-term problem for the next several months. Until that battery, I don't think there's really a plan of attack to how to put that out. We're just on going to be on alert until it does die down. But I also just want to say that one of the reasons that we like this power plant is we do not permit it because there are zero emissions associated with its operation. When it's operating correctly, when there's obviously an upset, that's a problem, but we don't permit accidents. Just like you're not gonna probably sue your neighbor if their house burns down, that's an accident. And we'll say in the grand scheme of things, what happened in the Los Angeles fires greatly dwarfs anything that's occurred here, but still it's a very real concern. And there were a number of elements identified in the pre-planning documents. We reviewed some of the air modeling dispersion models before the plan was adopted and approved. So we're aware of what might be in that. So moving forward, we hope to have a group of individuals that can address these types of situations that will be provided for in our budget that you will get a chance to review and approve down the line. The next item is, I could probably spend the rest of the day on this, but this is the impacts of the new administration on our function. It's not good news. It's not good news, especially for people at EPA. EPA has basically been told not to call us, not to talk to us. We can call them, but they can't really talk to us. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my career. And people are being let go, especially anybody that has worked in the DEI or disadvantaged community world. Those people are gone at EPA. It looks like potentially half the staff is going to be laid off, and political appointees without any technical experience are going to be coming in pledging fealty to the new administration. So it's a very scary time, which brings me to another issue, and I've let Jimmy Panetta know about this, is that we have a Inflation Reduction Act. There's two IRAs. There's the Infrastructure Recovery Act and then the Inflation Reduction Act. We were awarded about $680,000 for modernization and updating to our current air monitoring system, which is greatly needed. It will help us respond to events like the power plant as well. Unfortunately, it's been sort of a shell game. We cannot get access to those funds, but through several judge orders, it's been sort of intermittent. There was one day where we could get into our funds and we immediately withdrew $150,000. And I think that went through. But we have been spending money against this grant. We have a signed agreement with EPA and we are being told they no longer are going to honor that. And so we run the danger of spending monies that we do not have revenue for. We can do it, we'd rather not, since we put a lot of time and effort into securing this grant. We also get about $400,000 a year in what's called Section 105 of the Clean Air Act and Section 103 grants. That's not a whole lot compared to our overall operating budget, but it helps offset costs to industry, helps defray some of those costs. So if that money goes away, we're gonna have to raise fees. And that's not always a very popular thing to do with our regulated businesses. So it's pretty dire right now. We're also worried about, you know, how we look to the federal government with respect. We have a statement of racial equality on our website. I mean, I'm sort of toying with, is that going to get us into trouble at the federal level? Because we receive federal grants, we give money to disadvantaged communities, and that might be problematic down the road as well. But we can pretty much guarantee that EPA is not going to be around to help us do our job like they have been. And they needed more staff, if anything, and now they're going to be pretty much decimated. So it's pretty dire, it's pretty concerning, it's pretty scary. And I'll keep you informed if anything else comes of this, but we're not the only ones. So, the courts are going to be clogged with lawsuits regarding sort of the abandonment of these agreements. Basically, they've reneged on the contracts, and I'm not sure how they can do that. And they're not following the federal judges out of Rhode Island's orders to make those payments available. So pretty scary. So moving on to good news, just in engineering compliance, I wanted to introduce you to Taylor Orcutt, our new air quality technician supporting the engineering division. Taylor graduated from UC Berkeley with a bachelor in system management and forestry and a minor in geospatial information science and technology. Before coming to MBAR, Taylor worked at Apple Maps for 4 years. Taylor's primary work in engineering will be reporting emissions inventory to the state. So we're really happy to have him staffed up, and he's gotten a hero's welcome so far. The hearing board will be meeting on a variance on February 26th. The variance allows a company to operate out of compliance with permit conditions or MBAR rules for a time based on specific findings. So the board delves into that. Currently, we only have 3 members on the 5-member board, and it makes getting a quorum together very difficult. So we need a registered engineer and a medical professional. If you have a doctor that's interested in doing something on the side, especially their pulmonologist or something, that would be great. A nurse could even, a practitioner, or a physician's assistant, medical professional, doesn't have to be a doctor. They could have a master's in public health like yours truly. So I also wanted to remind you, as I said earlier, that all new board members have the ability to appoint, can get up to 2 folks on our advisory committee. And to your point, Kim, the advisory committee is our first line of public outreach. So we use them to workshop ideas, and they represent the public at large. And that's really gone a long way to help get information out into the community and help the decision, give advice to the board on items that come before the board for approval. So typically they'll see any new rules, regulations, or programs that we're proposing and weigh in on that. And then you'll see their remarks presented at the board meeting in the form of comments. I don't know if this is going to happen now, but the U.S. Department of Justice finalized a rule implementing website content accessibility requirements for state and local governments. And this is especially problematic because a lot of our information on our website is not in what's considered ADA format, and that's got to be accessible to the public. So there's formatting that has to be done to all of our documents. We can sort of forestall some of these issues by parking them in an archive and making that available if requested. But what we've seen is the opposite is intent has happened, where people are just pulling information off their websites because it's not compliant, which really does a disservice to the public because then it's gone forever. So we'll be working on that. We do have until 2027 to get that in line, but with the new administration, that may take a back seat. I can imagine that happening. So. I think I'll just go through the really briefly. David talked about wood stove changeout program. We spent 100% of that. I was able to secure an additional $75,000 from Ventura, who couldn't spend their money because it's not as cold in Ventura. So they were more than happy to give us the money. And so we're able to put that good use up here. And then David talked about the land landscape equipment exchange program. And this is really wonderful. We've seen a lot of areas put the brakes on leaf blowers and that sort of thing because of noise primarily, but air pollution is certainly a concern there too. And we're working with those communities. We will be adding an additional $50,000. Mike Labar is not here, but that was a discussion point. Should we have extra money that we could disencumber? We've gone through all our monies available for this year for the vehicle incentives, but we were able to scare up another $50,000. So we'll add that to the program. And that could get us, you know, 40 more cars out on the street, electric vehicles. And then David may have mentioned this, but we have an electric school. It was recently delivered to the Monterey Peninsula Unified School District as part of our zero emission school bus program. The district was granted $116,000 stacked with $200,000 from Central Coast Community Energy. The combined grant of funding allowed them to essentially get the bus for free. So that's a real win-win. And speaking to school boards, they typically don't have margins. It's sort of like you can pay for 100% or nothing because they can't afford anything else. And there are some issues also with these are lower maintenance, higher technology dependent buses require charging platforms, and they don't operate great on hills. So if you have a hilly community, school buses aren't great in hills. So we actually encourage schools to look in the flatlands, to look for those schools that in the hills that bought electric buses because they want to sell them because they don't work that well. And then our spare the air alert continues. As David talked about, we didn't call any since the program opened in November due to favorable meteorological conditions. But we still have a wood stove problem, and it's primarily in the San Lorenzo Valley area. And as I said to a lot of in my presentations regarding the Moss Landing plant fire, our monitors were picking up wood stove smoke up and down the jurisdiction, and indeed throughout the state from Sacramento to Santa Barbara. It's a problem, especially when it gets cold and we have stagnant air conditions. So we're working on the IRA grant, and we hope that that's going to really help bring our monitoring program up to speed. It's really needed and necessary. So we're probably going to spend the money anyways, and we've got enough in our reserves to back this up. But like I said, I think this is, they're basically a breach of contract if EPA doesn't pay us the money that they awarded us. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Rich. I believe we can.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. That's automatic. I don't even think when I say that.
Yeah, just a lot of important information.